Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey Poddleters, I hope you're doing well. In this week's episode, I speak to Moya Lothian-McLean about what three things she wishes she had been taught in school, namely political philosophy, addiction, and achievement myths. We do talk a lot about social media and the way that online discourse often dominates our perception of the world as well. I found this conversation personally very cathartic because I love a lot of the things that Moya writes and the way that she talks about things. And so I feel like I'm very rambly in this episode because I quite selfishly was just loving talking to Moya. But I hope that you still find it really enjoyable to listen to. It is a lot more of a conversation this episode than interview, but I hope that's still enjoyable to listen to. We do also talk about fitness addiction and dieting. So if that is going to be triggering for you, I just thought I'd point that that does happen about halfway through the episode. We actually recorded this episode prior to me doing a post on Instagram about having not really worked out. And we talk about that in a lot more depth when it comes to kind of like body privilege and other privileges. So if you were following that when that happened online as well, then this might add a bit more context for that. But I really hope that you enjoy listening and do make sure to check out Moya's writing on Galdem. And she also is on lots of TV programs at the minute, doing interviews and stuff. So I'm sure you've seen her around. Anyway, I hope you enjoy listening. And as always, please do rate, review and subscribe. Bye. Hello and welcome to Adulting. Today I'm joined by Moya Lothian-McLean. You go hello.
Okay. Hello, hi. It's nice to have me on. Let's start that again. Let's do that again. Sorry, I completely missed that.
Don't
as far
worry.
As I am much more professional than this normally, I was just like, just vibing in the corner.
Just vibing.
Yeah, don't let's worry. Do that again. Sorry about
okay.
that.
Okay. It's quite funny. I kind of want to leave it in. Hello and welcome to Adulting. Let's just go from here. It's fun. I love it.
Okay, let's leave it in. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm very excited to be here today.
Thank you for coming on. I'm super excited to talk to you. I'm loving this weather. I'm sweating now. You were just saying you're getting hot. It's suddenly sunny. The world's looking up a little bit. How are you feeling at this moment in time?
I'm feeling okay. I'm a little tired from a lot of work, but the fact that I can now feel sweat pooling under my arms is it's a positive sign that we're getting close to summer, which is inching there. So that's a good thing. I like to smell bad.
It is good. I mean, I've definitely got a Sula going on. But yeah, you've been very busy. I found you through your work and love reading everything that you put out. So I wonder, for people who maybe haven't been introduced to you yet or haven't come across you, could we get an introduction to Moya, who you are, what you do, a little bit about you?
Of course. I'm a journalist. I'm currently the politics editor at Galdem, which is a online and print publication which amplifies the voices of people of colour from marginalised genders, which essentially means everyone except cis men. So I do that, but on the side I'm also a freelance journalist working across a range of things. So I'm currently working on a podcast with a company called Broccoli Content, which will be out soon, and it's about British slavery, and that's all I can say. And I also do a lot of like visual work. So I do videos for the likes of like the BBC, and I write articles for anyone who will let me write articles for them. Yeah, so mainly politics-based, but I like to dabble.
Amazing. So what was your background? How did you get into the angle of politics? Did you study politics at university? What was your background before getting into this angle of journalism?
I did not study politics at university. I did history at university, actually. So not that I can remember that much of it, given I went when I was 18 and did what every person when they're 18 goes to university does, which is basically mess around for about 3 years and then pull their shit together at the very last minute. So yeah, I didn't do politics at university, but I guess I had a vested interest in politics as not as the Westminster sort of centric politics that we think of it as, but as I think it should be, which is, you know, the sort of rules that govern everyone's lives and the structures that dictate how we live. So in that sense, I was always interested in the way the world worked and why we did certain things as a collective society or as individuals within that society, looking out for their own interests. So that was why I got into politics. And it was, I almost fell into writing about politics because there was a real dearth of, I think, young politics writers of colour. And that's not because they're not interested. That's because often there's barriers there, which mean that they don't get into it. And I was lucky in the sense that I was, you know, middle class, I'm mixed race. So I was almost able to move in as a bridge between these circles. So people often got me on board and then they realised that I had something to say. But also I've been lucky in the sense that I've come of age at the time when publications like Gaudium exist, who specifically are there to make sure there are those platforms and that we can talk about these things as, you know, people of colour looking at politics in a slightly different way than perhaps the lobby journalists who just want to talk about the budget, which is important, but it's not the entirety of politics. So I fell into it almost. I just was writing about the world around me, and that is politics. So then I got into the official title of political journalist. And once you're there, then everyone's just like, oh, yeah, yeah, they know about politics. So it's sort of like a co-sign operation.
So I don't know if I'm looking at this just from my angle of when I've come across you, but for me, it feels like you've really come into your stride with your writing, and I see your work being shared everywhere in my corner of the internet. And it seems like you've got lots of eyeballs on you. And from looking on the outside, it looked like that happened quite quickly, like you suddenly were launched into being a voice that people were going, oh, I wonder what Moya's got to say. I remember like sending you a DM on Twitter being like, you're the only person I listen to because you have a really balanced bit. It's true, like you would really break things down in a way that I would go, oh, thank you, this makes sense. Like, it's not hysterical, it's not like histrionics, it's not kind of going like, oh my god, this is bad, this is good. You would give a really good breakdown. You're very skillful at doing that. And I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but did you have suddenly a big kind of explosion of eyeballs on you? And how has that been as a writer? Because I know that people who are naturally writers aren't always comfortable with that level of exposure. How do you feel about it?
That's actually a really interesting question, because it's something me and my therapist have been discussing at length recently. So it's funny, I've been writing for years. So I've been writing since I was at university, since I was, I would say, 19, when I started out as a music journalist, and I wrote on the side, and it was paid from the very beginning for me because I was really, really lucky. And so I wrote for Vice, and then I moved, I worked as a stylist for 3 years. But the explosion thing is simply because I started working for places like Gaudium, and people started following me on social media. That's the reason. It's like the work I've been doing, I haven't been doing exactly the same the whole time because I haven't had the platform or the capacity to do the same work, but I've been doing very similar work in little pieces where I could. People just haven't seen it. So now it feels, for example, I followed you on Instagram for years since I was at university as well. So it's like, it's really interesting to me that now people that I used to follow are like, oh wow, I really like what you're saying. And I'm like, that's very funny. It's a strange dynamic. I think it's given me a real insight into how, you know, social media will push people to the forefront, and it's a very like narrow sort of I don't want to say focus, that's not the right word, it's like a channel. It's like once someone gets a bit of traction, the growth is almost exponential, because then more and more people just go to them and think that they must have something to say because everyone's following them. And even if they don't quite understand what they're saying, which is not what I mean about my work, it's like even if someone doesn't quite agree, they'll still keep following that person because they're like, oh, but everyone else is on this, so they must be saying something good, which is also why there's a lot of like mediocre commentators out there, in my opinion, who have just been pushed up to certain heights because some people are like, oh yeah, they're good, and I'm like, what are you talking about? They're saying nonsense, they're talking shit. I'm sure there's people who think that about me as well, but it is very much a case of I've been behind the scenes, or even on the scenes, but just not perhaps noticed for literally since 2014. So it's felt like an overnight explosion of eyeballs, but I think it was because I've been working as the politics editor at Gaudium as cover before, But when I officially got the job, that also coincided with a couple of bits more freelance work I'd been doing that I think had got me a bit more attention. More radio shows were starting to get me on because they like I can talk. That's also a thing. If you can talk, you start getting that traction as well. So it was a lot of factors came together, and that's why it feels like overnight it's only been me. And it's been a bit stressful because, and I'm sure you're very aware of this, because as someone who's built a platform and has and knows what it's like to suddenly have a lot of people have expectations of you that maybe don't even have any bearing on who you've been and the work you've done, because you're suddenly seen as a voice, and sort of humanity of you stripped away, and it's just like, oh, they're a voice, they got this to say. And it's like I'm trying very hard to make sure I'm not distracted from what I actually want to do, and I'm not going to just start doing things because I'm offered them and because suddenly it's like, oh, she's a voice, let's get her onto this program or this program. And I'm like, okay, it's fine for me to say no to that if that's not something that I would have done previously before. If I'd been offered, they weren't offering, but now they are. And it's like, if I didn't want to do that before, there's no reason I should do that now if I don't think it's a subject within my area, if I don't think it's something that's part of my like long-term goals. You have to keep focused, because let's face it, you can get lost in the sauce. The clout is tempting, but the clout is not satisfying. So that's the way I feel about it. But yeah, it's been interesting. It's been funny to see. And it's also stressful because it's something I write about. Like I write about how we push young women onto these pedestals and we push them into being like the voice. And for it to then happen, I'm not saying it's happened to me to the level it does the people I write about, but for it to happen even a little bit to me is very like, I know exactly what's going on. And so you have to fight tooth and nail to sort of resist being sucked into that. But at the same time, when people push expectations on you, once it's out there, it's like you can't completely change their perception of you. So it's interesting. It's like trying to relinquish control of that image of myself while also accepting that I can still do the things that I always wanted to do, and it doesn't matter if that's not what people expect me to do.
Yeah, it's definitely really hard managing that people's perceptions of you, because also you don't want to let people down. You're like, it's lovely when people think highly of you. So there's that weird element of like, oh, but this is a compliment, but actually it's so damaging, as you say, because you end up bending over backwards to keep up this image that people have projected onto you, like she's this and that. And then it's so flattening. And then one day you wake up and you're like, oh my God, literally I am just the opinion girl or whatever it is. And you've spent years probably trying to, like, especially as women, I think we spend years trying to figure out who we are, all the parts of us that make us us. And then suddenly one thing that we say becomes like the timestamp of who we are. And people are like, great, let's go back to that thing that you said and we'll keep you there. And it does mean that it's difficult because you've got to manage your own expectations and everyone else's while still trying to keep going. So I think that it is hard being in that position. But I do think you're straddling it very well, especially because you're in a position where you aren't talking about yourself. I think when you're like an influencer or someone, you're kind of constantly having to be brought back to talking about you. And obviously I want to be talking more about you here, but the good thing, I guess, about journalism is you're given the freedom to explore other people. And so you can talk about you in a way that isn't, you kind of infer what you think without actually giving stuff away. So I think that that's kind of like maybe a slightly safer place to be, but not necessarily. But I'm really excited to have you on. And as you said, like, people do think you're a good talker, and I think you're great. I've listened to you on so many things. I've read so many things. So I was really interested to hear what you would say your three things that you wish you'd been taught in school were. And I'm glad that I did ask, because they're great. So the first one that you said kind of ties into what you're talking about right at the beginning, which is political philosophy. I also wish I'd been taught this, because as you said again right at the beginning, I thought politics was party politics that was over there. I was never going to understand it. It was red and blue and like nothing to do with me. And I never realized that all of these small conversations that we're having about like my really entry level feminism conversations or about who we were going to date or what we were going to wear that actually were really political in lots of ways. So yeah, I'd love to know when you had that, I guess, that political awakening and when you really started to understand and can figure out more a bit about how everything sort of, it's all just one melting pot of ideas, I guess.
It's interesting. I think I'm actually going through it now, to be honest with you, that political awakening, as it were. It's very funny. So when I talk about political philosophy, it's something that I still am not completely au fait with, and I will have to do a lot more education and reading, which is why I wish in school we've been taught it. And political philosophy specifically is sort of the it's sort of like the theorizing, and I'm sure you know about this, but I'm just explaining it so that it's for the listeners, in case they're like, what is political philosophy? And if there are any political philosophy professors out there who think I'm messing up this explanation, please do not tweet me about it. Political philosophy is sort of how to deploy public power to maintain survival and quality of human life. So it's theorizing about how we should do politics, how politics should be, like, what is our political life? Like, what are the systems we should be living by? Should we, how can we make, you know, a better life for everyone? And it's you have your old guard of like the Platos and the Aristotles and all of that, and then you got the middle grounds of like the utilitarianism and the Rousseaus, and then you've got like Marx. So these are names that you hear and you're like, okay, I know these names. What are they on about? What are they saying? And I think, you know, in school, when I talk about wanting to learn in school, I don't mean that we'd have to learn, you know, every single nitty gritty bit about what St. Augustine thought about sin, because that is something that's quite in depth. And, you know, as a teenager, you probably, it's hard to engage, but even the broad topic of learning how to think in that way, of learning to think that politics isn't, you know, a cut and dried, because when we talk about like party politics, that's political science. That's how politics is, you know, sort of it's enacted in the public sphere, as it were. But political philosophy, it's like learning to think and imagine about politics, and learning to think about a world and what you want that world to look like, and what things could be like, and what is the best way. Like talking about that, just like it's those conversations that you have at 2 a.m. perhaps with your friends when you've got like glasses of wine in your hand, and you're like, but imagine if we had this system in place, and you know, would you want a world where everyone is like, is a world where everyone is equal actually possible? And it's those kind of conversations about those systems. And I think it's, you know, we obviously get taught how to think in a certain manner. We get taught that some things are just part of the fabric of life. We get taught that some things are just this, and that's the way they are. So with the two-party system, for example, we get taught that, you know, you're either left or you're right, and that's sort of it. And then you get older and you realize that actually within that there's so many more positions. You know, you could be on the left and you could have complete different views to someone else on the left, and then there's, you know, you have all the libertarians and all of that, and there's so many different ways that people think about the world, but I don't think we're taught in how to imagine them. And I think right now is, you know, I guess capitalism is sort of is political philosophy. So thinking our way out of the system that we're currently in. I don't know if you read Mark Fisher at all, but he's a philosopher. He was an academic. He's a philosopher. He's a very famous sort of like, I think, Marxist tradition philosopher, but he's really accessible. Like, for example, his book Capitalist Realism is really popular among young left-wingers like me, because when you read it, he's talking about, for example, his students in class and being so overstimulated by, the media world and the internet and online around them, that they can't engage in day-to-day life. And that's sort of like philosophy of how you engage with life. And he says in his book about capitalist realism, it's like we can't even think. It's easier for he talks about films, for example, like Children of Men or The Day After Tomorrow, and these apocalyptic films, and how it's easy for us to imagine the end of the world than it is for us to imagine the end of capitalism. So, you know, you take the bank bailout in 2008, and it was like the one thing in the bank bailout was we cannot, like, the system had failed, but it cannot fail. It will continue. It will have to continue. So they bailed them all out, and they were like, capitalism, even though it had failed, and those messages around what capitalism was meant to be, aka this big system that it could never fail. It was never going to fail because it was always ongoing. And even though it failed, then and it had proven that it could fail, there was suddenly the bailout, because we couldn't imagine this end to capitalism. We can't imagine these alternative systems because we're so deep in it. And it's things like political philosophy that allow us to start thinking outside of that and challenge these assumptions. Like at one point in the very near past, the 1970s, before the 1980s, capitalism wasn't the given. It was just the new system. It was like they had the second gasp of neoliberalism that brought it back in the 80s. But there was other systems that people had in place. You know, the Soviet Union, I'm not saying it was a great thing, but it's like that was an alternative system. And the fact that those two things exist at the same time is impossible do imagine now that there's any alternatives. So it's really interesting. And this political philosophy, I just think that, you know, you started asking about my political awakening per se. I think, Jenny, it is happening now, because it's only now that I'm starting to be able to sit down and think there must be other things than this, because what this is that I'm living in is not making me or and so many others happy, but we also feel completely helpless. And I think that's linked to certain consumptive habits with the internet and things. But because I've spent so long online and just engaging in online discourse, and I grew up on that, it's only now that I'm just so dissatisfied with it that I'm pulling myself away and starting to think about, you know, to read outside of that and engage in the act of philosophizing. I think discourse online is it's weird, because it comes from the practice of discoursing and having philosophical discussions, but it's almost the online manner of it is so fast and so furious and so many just like snippets. It's almost the death of proper philosophizing, which I don't think is the correct word. I don't think philosophizing is the word I'm trying to say, but there's almost the death of like that conversation, because it's such an individualistic platform. So only now is it that like I'm actually, maybe it's because I have the space as well, because I'm now working full time in a job that demands I think about politics and demands I think about it from a perspective that is outside the mainstream per se. And I'm not saying I do that yet, but it's saying, you know, one of my aims for Gaudem, my section in Gaudem is very much that I'm like, how can we push these conversations forward? Okay, I know that, you know, we know racism exists. We know it's here. That's me to just get people to write another piece being like, racism is here and it's bad. How is that improving, you know, our audience's understanding of these issues? How is that improving how we think about them? It's not. So how can we think outside of them? How can we report on stories that show, you know, alternative ways of thinking about this, or ways to push this forward, and ways to sort of open up the discussion and make it so that, you know, when you read a book that sort of gives you an insight and context and knowledge that you haven't had before, and you feel so nourished by it, we're very starved of that nourishment. And I think things like political philosophy, if I'd learned to think like that from an early age, I think I wouldn't have spent so long dithering about online and engaging conversations that mattered but perhaps were almost a distraction from the action outside.
Such a good answer. As you were saying that, you just reminded me that when I was at uni in my first year and we learned about the concept of ideology, like what ideology is. And they were like, it's really, and I think, I remember our lecture, I think you used the example of capitalism, like, can you imagine a different version? And we were like, no. And they were like, this is ideology. You're trained to believe that there is no other alternative, that the moment you're living in now is what it's always been like. It's like the current conversation, or like more recently, everyone's been talking about abolishing the police or like defunding the police, and people are like, you can't get rid of the police. And you're like, of course you can. It's all made up. Like, there is a world without the police. But you're right, actually tapping into that mindset, being able to imagine, is really hard, and it does take time. It's interesting, this idea of like, there's so much conversation on the internet, there's so much discourse, so much rhetoric. Like, if I read the word discourse one more time, I'm gonna cry. But this pandemic's made us slow down in reality, but if anything, I think it's really even quickened the pace online. I don't know if you'd agree with that. Like, if it's kind of worsened our appetite for news and information. And
yeah, I 100% agree with what you just said about the pandemic quickening the pace online. I don't know if you've experienced this. Are you finding that you're trying to, that it's made you perhaps finally think, I'm going to change my habits with the online world, and I'm going to move away, because this manner of conversation is not one that serves me anymore?
Yeah, well, I've actually had interestingly, you were saying to me before we started talking about how being like an influencer, being online, means you always have to be present. And what's happened with me online is I've stopped thinking that I have to. I used to think I had to show up online every day and have something to say. And actually, I'm doing loads of stuff now that, so like, I'm writing things in my free time, I'm reading, I'm working on stuff that may never go anywhere and that I might never show to anyone, because that's better for my long-term career goals, my life, whatever, than kind of what I would do, which is scrambling every day to get something up online, be ready to be viewed by people every single day, which feeds into, you know, it would help me with my career in the short term. And it means that you're kind of doing what you're supposed to be doing, but it's so fundamentally unhelpful for your mental health, for your general education and like acquirement of knowledge. I don't think that like the pace with which people read stuff and then immediately have an opinion on it, like, terrifies me. And I know we spoke about that in that Twitter exchange that time when something had happened on Women's Hour and people were having like opinions. And I was thinking, God, that's moved really quickly from kind of like, how have you had the space within a minute to form an opinion? And so, yeah, my attitude towards how I show up online is changing a lot, in that I'm watching a lot more and trying to sit back a bit more and take time with things, because it's turned into like a really weird rat race that I feel like it's a stampede and that you're going to get trampled, basically. And I'm trying to like sit back a little bit online.
Do you think that's, you know, what you're describing there to me is changing the art of the way you think about things, which is exactly the way I see, you know, if I was taught political philosophy from a young age, it's that idea of how we think about things, how we respond to things, how we see the world shaped around us. And I wonder, like, what for you, you say, obviously, this being part of this rat race has done that. Has that had an impact on, you know, in the recent years when you formed your political opinions, or you started, how your political opinions changed at all? Have the way that you engage with sort of politics, and you're talking about feminism, has that changed? Like, because this is all part of the conversation that I'm having about this political philosophy idea, which is, you know, now we're having to unlearn the things we're taught and relearn them. And imagine if we were just taught how to think about that at school.
So I guess what's happening with me is I went from 0 to 100 with my political awakening, in terms of like, I was at university, I suddenly learned a lot about politics and inequality and the world and feminism and history. And I was like, wow, I listened to The Guilty Feminist every day. It was the most amazing thing I've ever heard in my life. And then now I've kind of slowed down and realized that I need to read a fucking lot and be more up to date. And then I can comment in a week, in a month, but just not straight away.
That's the exposition I'm in. I think it's really exciting. It's really exciting when you realize how much you don't know, and that you're not a fully formed person who has every answer, and that, you know what, you can go and sit down and read a book, and that's so exciting. I don't have to be online, and I don't have to, you know every single thing about the way the world works and the way the world should work. And I can read different views on that and, you know, form my own opinion using critical analysis rather than just looking down the timeline and coming to a consensus, which is, I think, something that's so, you know, it doesn't make you happy either, that consuming it. Do you know what I find is so interesting? That every conversation I have at the moment, it will always return to this being online. And I think what we're going to talk about later will also come back to this. But it's because it's such a fundamental part of our lives, and it's like divesting from that space in a way that's healthy for us. Because it's, you know, there are great things about being online. And I think when we talk about it, we're talking primarily about social media, because, you know, if I spend hours scrolling the encyclopedias online, or scrolling like these really interesting articles about the, you know, politics and political systems, that's a lot more nourishing than sitting on Twitter and having the same conversations over and over again in the echo chamber, and not being able to, and I talked about this the other day, not being able to pool that knowledge in a way that forms a collective dialogue rather than just like, you know, it's there one day and it's gone the next day, and then someone else is saying it the next day, but they can't see the person was saying it in the first place. So it's just like an ongoing repetition. And yeah, having those discussions with the people offline is so jarring, because you realize that you're speaking in a register and an absolutism, as you pointed out, that is just not reflective of the world around you. And that there's a very, you know, you've got millions of people online, but it's still a very small pocket of people. And when I go outside in the street, and if I talk to one of my neighbors, it's like, would they be speaking the same register I am? Would they understand what I'm talking about? It's like, my mum had this conversation with me actually, where she said, you know, we're very much nearly on the same page when it comes to politics. She's the person who raised me, so I have similar political views to her, probably even a bit more left because of, you know, the spaces I've been in, the experiences I've had. But she said to me, "You're always campaigning at me, Moya. You're always campaigning." And instead of having a conversation, I was just campaigning at her. And I was trying to, and a lot of the stuff is stuff she knows, or she's experienced, or she's literally lived through, you know, she came of age as 20-year-old something in the 70s. So she was there through all of the, and it's not to say that, you know everything just because you've lived it, because I don't think that's true. I think lived experience has to pair with learning and education and actually an analysis. But the fact that I was campaigning about her on topics that she'd already seen and done, was, it just made me annoying. It just made me really annoying and sound like I knew everything when I knew very little. So it's, and once you realize that you don't have to have those absolutes, it's so freeing, like existing in a space where, you know, you break through these binaries. And it does allow you to think more about other binaries and things like that. You know, I've always been someone who's said, you know, I thought about the gender binary as not being that absolute thing. But it really, once you see those links in other spaces and think you can look, oh, you can move past this sort of binary of thinking, it opens up every other thing. That's the point. It's like none of these things exist in a vacuum. They're all part of the interconnected way we live and think about our lives. And just breaking down those initial barriers will lead on to other areas that you didn't even imagine. It's like thinking of, you know, I've always been like, I'm a cis woman, but I'm like, do I have to be a cis woman just because I don't like, I'm not saying I'm non-binary, but it's like these ideas of thinking about yourself beyond that and seeing like, oh, just because I have tits, that doesn't make me a woman. That makes me, you know, a person with tits. And it's like thinking beyond those binaries in a really exciting way and having those, just any assumptions you've ever made about yourself challenged, but on your terms. So yeah, that's, I just think absolutism is it's tiring and it's not a fun way to live your life in the world.
I think this leads quite nicely onto your second thing, which is addictions, because I think that very nature of social media being so heightened, so emotive, is what makes it very addictive. And I don't know if that was what you were going to talk about with your addictions, but I certainly have realized in this pandemic that I'm addicted to social media for sure.
Absolutely. It was one of the main sort of like, I think my addiction to my smartphone, specifically the social media apps on my smartphone, has probably been one of the most damaging things in my life. But it's also been one of the ones that's the most normalized. And I've had, you know, I've had a fitness addiction, exercise addiction, which I think from seeing your posts on social media, you probably can speak to, and we can discuss that a bit because it's quite common. You know, but that one also, and I have another addiction, or rather something that threatened to become addiction. And I won't say exactly what it was, but it was involving substances. And that's something I'm very much in recovery for in a really positive way. Like I'm very clean of it now, but it's something that if I talked about that properly, which I'm not quite ready to do, but I can talk around it and I'm very happy to do that. If I properly talked about that openly, there would be a lot of stigma and shame that came with that. And it would reflect on me in a way that talking about my smartphone addiction doesn't. And I can talk about my fitness addiction now because it's, you know, I passed that, and I really do believe that talking about that fully, like that's in the past. Well, it always kind of carries with you, but that's something that like we can talk about because it's also been normalized to the point to talk about that on social media, funnily enough. And it's interesting me comparing the different ways that I feel able to discuss these separate addictions. Because one of them is involving, you know, substances. It's something that's very shameful. It's something that's seen as a loss of control. One of them is involving my smartphone, which is seen as so normalized because it's just a part of how you function in everyday life and how you engage and how, you know, I build my platform and my brand, as they like to call it, and how, you know, you interact with the world around you now. And then, you know, your fitness addiction, that's almost something you can talk about because it's like, it came from like the pursuit of wanting to have a certain body image, but it's more about control. But because it's you know, trying to look a conventional way almost, that's, it's not that it seems something good, but it seems something far more acceptable. It's understandable. So the separations between these three different addictions and the reasons behind it, which all come back to the same thing, which I'll talk about in a minute, but it's just so funny to see the difference and to see the comparison and the contrast in how I feel about them, how people feel about them, and what that tells us about where we're living right now.
Congratulations, first of all, on coming out of your addiction with your substance. That's amazing, Tara, and I'm very proud of you. It's so difficult to break a habit, especially an addiction to something like that. And the second thing I was going to say was, with the fitness addiction, in a very sinister and cynical take, I actually think that fitness addiction is kind of seen as a good thing, especially, maybe not especially with women, but because it's a form of self-flagellation, and it's kind of like, it's a commitment to being regimented. There's something really sinister about the way that women are lauded, like a chat. It's like some weird, like chaste. There's something in it that I think is the actual addiction, irrespective of the results, the actual sacrifice of giving up food, of giving up that pleasure, is something that is weirdly celebrated in women, irrespective of how small they are. The actual act of being on a diet, in a weird way, is celebrated. I know that sounds really fucked up.
It definitely does make sense. I think it's almost, I think now the way we look at diets, I would say mostly, if you hear the word diet, I think most people think diet, and I think there was a bit of shame involved with the act of dieting itself, because the way of thinking about it is now like the dieting is the bad thing, but the fitness, the going to the gym, the working out 5, 6, 7 times a day, the act of that, giving up the hour, not going. So when I had my fitness addiction, or rather when I was in the throes of it really badly, I was working out, I would say 6 times a week. I would do it every single evening after a full day at work. I would, you know, it didn't matter if my boyfriend at the time would see me, I couldn't do it. I couldn't go out with my friends until I'd done it. I'd fit in this working out. And also I was very disciplined with my, like, that's the thing, discipline, again, that word, with my diet at the same time. But I would never be like, I'm dieting. I'd just be like, oh, I'm you know, I am eating these foods. Like it was, and at the start I gave up like sugar and stuff like that. But then I went back to eating, sorry, I should have trigger warning all this. Then I went, we can stick it in post edit. We'll stick it in post edit. But then I went back to eating, you'd call a full healthy diet. But then I went back to eating like what I call a full healthy diet. And I was still definitely addicted to the fitness element. That was sort of like, as you say, that self-flagellation, that punishment, that work. It was showing this work that I was putting in, and the control and discipline of pushing my body and punishing my body in that sense. So I think dieting itself has more of shame, because you associate it with, you know, like the Atkins diet. It's this very old-fashioned, outdated idea of how to punish yourself as a woman. But the fitness, now that's something different. That's something that's, you know, it's this almost like a fresh new way to go about it. And it's your what's the word? You're toning up, you're streamlining, you're pushing yourself in that way. Dieting, if you want to do something that's like seen as acceptable, and it's now intermittent fasting, because that's like the new age spiritual version of getting your body adhering to the conventional norms, as it were. But yeah, so I think dieting, you know, if I hear a friend saying they're dieting, I'm like, what are you doing? But if I understand more when a friend is like, oh, I'm going to the gym all this time, X, Y, and Z, I've got this very detailed plan, etc. And then I'm like, oh yeah, you know, there's that subconscious thing which is like, oh yeah, they're bettering themselves in some way. And it's like, I don't know if they are. I really don't know if they are. And it's obviously, fitness is a wonderful thing, but the addiction to it has so much more bound up in it.
I agree with you. Obviously, if my friend says they're dieting, I'm like, you don't need to go on a diet. And my immediate response is, again, a prepackaged social media one that I've like almost said so many times over the years that it just comes out, because diet is such a dirty word now in the reverse. And so that happens. But with the fitness that's happened to me in the pandemic is like, I've basically not worked out this year. I've just been going on walks. And I don't think ever in the last 6 or 7 years that I've ever not exercised. And it's kind of been, it's semi-conscious in that like, I hate doing home workouts, but it's also just, I feel so emotionally drained from the pandemic that I was like, I don't have the physical energy to do something really strenuous. So I'm just going to go on walks. And I feel nothing about it. I don't care that I'm not exercising. But sometimes I think about, oh my God, me 4 years ago, a bit like you were saying, like, wouldn't have seen your boyfriend. I would have been panicking that I hadn't exercised. I would have been finding ways to exercise. I would have been walking like a million steps a day. This pandemic, had it happened to me when I was in the throes of my like disordered eating and fitness addiction, I don't know. I would have found it so difficult. I would not have been able to deal with the fact that I couldn't go to the gym. Whereas this time around, I'm like, oh well, I'll just go for a walk. Like, it's amazing how my mindset shifted. But when did you break off that addiction? And like, do you think, I saw that you said something about this on Instagram the other day, and it is interesting. There's been like a wave of our generation of women getting fitness addictions, kind of overcoming them, and now being like very confessional about that fact. Were you in time with that kind of wave of that happening?
Yeah, 100%. As I said, I as a young adult, I guess teenager, I followed your Instagram from the start. Like, I was in the fitness bubble community. I followed everyone. I was on the Kayla program, but I hated it, so I quit that. And sorry, Kayla. And yeah, so I'm very much of age. I'm 26 this year. In fact, in 26 in a week. So I'm very much of that era, I guess, that's grown up coming of this particular age online and, you know, at university, just when this sort of like the amateur fitness person to influence a pipeline happened. Because I think a lot of young women my age who became fitness influencers, I don't know if this was your journey too, when they did that, they started out as, you know, just people part of the fitness communities online that started building up organically. And they were usually at university, so they had much more spare time to engage in that fitness world and work out and post those workouts. And it became like a side hobby. And then suddenly they found themselves with these thousands of followers who were like, every single move, it was like, oh wow, this is now my career, I guess. This is who I am. And that becomes your life. So I was on the other side of that. I didn't want to be a fitness influencer, but I was very much following those journeys. And for me, I guess I only started coming out of it. I wouldn't say I'm still out of it. I work out 3 times a week. I do one 20-minute run and then I do 2 full workouts with rest days. So it's much better now. But I still get probably a little panicky if I didn't do one of those things, I'd probably feel a little off, which is still something I have to work on. And it's very hard. It's really hard because it is part of the way I control my life. And that is something I constantly struggle with. But the reason when I started, I guess, tackling the fitness addiction was probably, it was probably when I met my current boyfriend, because he had knowledge of it. Let's just say he had knowledge of these kind of things. And he was very much like, in a very loving, kind way, how funny, he just tried to call me. He can feel his ears burning. In a very loving and kind way. He's like, are you talking about me on a podcast? In a really, really, this caring, loving way, he recognized that it wasn't normal that I was giving up so much time and energy to get these workouts in, and that I panicked and became very distressed, and I'd always pull up my jumper and look at my stomach in the mirror when I was passing it by without thinking. It was this unconscious thing I always would do, and I still do it sometimes. And he was like, I think you've got a bit of an issue here, and do you want to talk about it a bit more? And I knew deep down I had an issue, and for a while I maintained it, and then slowly, with sort of his help and encouragement, I tested out taking down my workouts to, you know, 4 a week or only doing like a little bit. And then I took them down to 3 big workouts a week. And then I started only doing 2 workouts a week. And it's only this year I've started running again. And that's because it's only 20 minutes. It's not a hard run. But I started running because I would never run before in my life. And I was like, I want to do something that's just a bit different, and I hate running, and I think it's good for me to actually challenge myself a little bit. So I started doing a run at the start of this year just to prove I could. And now I do it just on Mondays. But if I don't feel up to it, I won't. But it's that idea of like slowly having to reduce it down. And as you said, with your experience this year, you know, realizing the world's not going to fall in, you're not going to change that much. And even if you did, it wouldn't be a bad thing, although that would be something hard to cope with. But the sky is not going to fall in, and it will keep going, and you will still feel okay about yourself if you give these things up. But just even taking that first step needed sort of him to hold my hand in a very big way to make me feel okay to do that. And that's why having people around you that love you is so important for dealing with addictions, as it were. And he's also someone he's the person who also helped me with the substance as well. So I wouldn't say I owe him, because I don't feel like you owe your partners, but he's a very big light in my life, and he helped me realize a lot of things. And he got me to also he's also helped me finance my therapy. So this man is literally recovery central, I'd say. But yeah, so it's that kind of thing. It's like I do think that you can't deal with addictions totally on your own, and that's really okay. But because we live in such an individualized world, we think that it's all like, if you can't deal with this thing on your own, you can't sort it out on your own, you're not able to do that, it's almost like a failure in yourself. And then you fall further into that shame spiral, which pushes you further down the route of, you know, these destructive habits. And it's like, all these things about addictions, all the roots of my addictions, they come from things that I've explored in therapy, which is certain ways I think about the world, certain guards, my protectiveness, my control, my fear of rejection, certain things and unhappiness, and understanding what I was searching for in these addictions, you know, my smartphone addiction, where I'm trying to fill this void, I'm trying to like constantly be stimulated, I'm constantly trying to find connection, but I'm not going to find it through my social media apps in the way I want. So I'm having to, and I'm now doing this thing where I have to build up like my, I have loads of wonderful, wonderful friends, but it's like for a long time, I've very much sort of pulled back and relied on social media to connect with these people, even if I could walk down the road and see them. And part of like the thing I'm doing in therapy is I'm getting over my fear of one-to-one, not just group, one-to-one interactions. So one-to-one interactions, and really trying to go and see them, or if I can't see them, Zoom them and spend time with people one-on-one, so that I get over that fear of not being enough, not bringing enough to the conversation, not feeling like, the reason that I've always been in groups, and the reason that I've often, you know, that the substance problems, is because I didn't feel like I had anything to offer myself, even though that, you know, people be like, that's not true, you're great, you're full of life, all of this. And it's like, that's fine. It didn't come from a rational place. It came from a very irrational place. It came from a lot of like issues that I've had, you know, my father left when I was very young. So I had a lot of like rejection issues around that. It's very run of the mill stuff, but it still was there. And these fears of like building these one-to-one connections with my friends and letting them get close enough to me, IRL, that, you know, you can be hurt, you can rely on someone or depend on someone. That's where a lot of this stuff's coming from, and like not feeling like you're enough. So like having to, you know, bring substances or bring, you know, this fun version of yourself and all of that. That's another thing. And then it's, you know, this exercise addiction and wanting to be, look, at least I'd look perfect, even if I wasn't sparkling company. So it's, and going to therapy and having my partner, you know, allow that, but also gently say to me, are you sure you're okay about like this thing? Are you sure this thing is like, you don't seem happy. You just don't seem happy. Those are the biggest factors in sort of tackling my addiction. So I'd say it's that support network, and it's also having access to things that can help you. You know, he allowed me access to therapy, which I'd never been able to do before because I hadn't had the disposable income to do it. And that, and my mum also helped pay for a bit of it, but he's primarily been helping me with it. And that itself is like a major privilege, but also be aware that if you don't have access to these things, that's like, it's not your fault if you cannot deal with it on your own. That was a very long answer.
Oh my God. No, when you were talking about your boyfriend, it genuinely made me well up. One, because it's just so lovely to hear when people are in really loving, supportive relationships. Like I just, and also because I love my boyfriend, Liz, it made me want to cry. It's so stupid, but it was just so sweet. I just love him. And it's so nice to have that support, and it's so important. And there's so many things you said that resonated with me. I mean, I'm in therapy as well now, which is, I have been since, I think, was it last year, November last year, maybe around then. The most revolutionary thing I've ever done. I agree with you. It's like,
oh my God, same. That was exactly the same.
Really? That's so funny. Yeah, it's just absolutely incredible. And the things I've learned about myself, like where these insecurities have come from, and like where, I don't know, it's just taking control and like learning all these things about boundaries. Anyway, with the phone thing, again, it's the same with me. The more I've been in therapy and I've unearthed maybe issues that I didn't realize that had come from my childhood or trauma or things like that, the less I've become dependent on validation from strangers or like external validation online. It's been a really interesting seesaw effect, watching how if you mend little things deeper down, some of these what seem like surface level problems do actually start to dissipate. Everything's kind of interconnected, I guess.
I 100% agree. And also I welled up talking about my boyfriend a bit. So it is really funny when I hear about other people's relationships like yours and you're like, I love him so much. I also get very emotional because I'm like, it's just so nice. it's just nice to have someone that shows up for you and cares. And I don't want people to listen to podcasts and be like, guys, shut the fuck up because stop talking about your boyfriends. But it changes a lot. And this can be a friend relationship too. I also want people to note that like this support and love, you can find that in your friends, and they, you know, you just, it's letting that person in a way that they can do that for you. And that's more than okay. And I think a lot of the time online as well, we pathologize relationships. So they have to be like this transactional thing of like, you know, who's doing the emotional labor, who's doing what. And it's like, that's not what they are. Relationships are how, you know, it's just about like letting someone love you and be there for you and be there when you need someone. And sometimes you don't recognize that you need someone. I don't know if you feel similarly, but it's like a lot of my life, I've been very much like, I'm so independent because of the things that I'm now like looking at in therapies. I'm so independent. I could do this all on my own. And even if I do need someone, I can't need someone, because if I start relying on someone, then you know, I everything else will just crumble because then they might go away when I need them. And that's just not how it has to work. And you don't have to be like alone in that. And it's, as you say this, you know, we're going to talk about therapy now. And I do want to say that therapy is not the be all and end all for everyone. It doesn't solve every single thing. And it is obviously a massive privilege to be able to get into it and afford it. I would, maybe in the show notes, we could put a couple of groups that are providing, you know, access to therapy for marginalized mm-hmm. people who don't have the money. That would be really helpful, because even though it's not the be all and end all, just having that space to talk is so important. But it's hard, because like the things I'm going to talk about are things that, like, without therapy, I wouldn't be able to discuss them. And without that therapy, you know, without mm-hmm. that access to this thing that is like a real privilege, I don't want people to think that they can't do, that they can do it on their own, because that's also, again, that narrative I was talking about. Like, if you know, you think that you should be able to do this all on your own, and you think that you should be able to like reproduce the structures of a therapeutic environment where you can sit and talk and have that and have those realizations on your own, because honestly you can't. And that is because our society is a very skewed, unequal place. And that is the thing. It's like we have made up all these sort of we've made up all these like myths about what you should be able to do and access individually, because we have made such an unequal society where people can't access that all at once. And we've made a scarcity myth, which is that sort of idea where, you know, there's a shortage of things, so we'll come up with solutions for it, such as, you know, talk about freelancing a lot online, like rate of freelancers massive gone up because there's no staff jobs in journalism. That's just one of those things. It's like the scarcity thing, and it doesn't have to be this way. That's, again, going back to my political philosophy point, we could have another world where you do have this mental health support, and you do have these kind of things, like not just therapy, but the other things that, you know, the other ways of dealing with mental health that people can access. And I think it is okay to say right now there is not enough of that, and it doesn't matter how many times we say it's time to talk on social media, that's not going to be the answer.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But anyway, going back to the addiction stuff, it is all interconnected. It is very much like, you know, like this, I wrote this essay on smartphone addiction the other day because I was finally able to sit down and be like, I don't get the same dopamine blast from having thousands of strangers want to like follow me online, because it doesn't mean as much anymore. It's not where my values lie, because that I've realized that's not where I get that satisfaction, and that's not like something that I need in my life to make me happy, because it just makes me feel a bit more empty. And it's like the things that make me happy, it's like hanging out with people that I love, it's talking to people that I love, it's having interesting conversations like these where you really can chew over stuff and be like, it's okay, we don't have all the answers. And, you know, going outside and painting my electric box and planting seeds and being slow. It's like you said, it's just being a bit slower. Mm. My dream is to, you know, move back to the countryside one day and live in the little cottage that I grew up in and just, you know, get off the rat race, as you say. But it's like that dream only exists because we're so overwhelmed by this stream of social media and there's not that balance yet. And maybe as I get older, I will be able to strike that balance in a way that makes it sustainable. But right now it's like, I just want to be able to breathe and figure out who I am now compared to who I was 5 years ago and what that means. And having the space to do that is an enormous privilege. And it's only come with the support of like my partner, my friends, and, you know, having a little bit extra money to do this stuff with. And that's the truth of it.
I'm going to share as well in the show notes, but a woman DM'd me about how you can actually apply for like free therapy through the NHS, and they're actually, it's a lot quieter than people think it is because everyone presumes it's so busy. It's actually slightly easier to get a referral. So I'm going to put the link to that because I shared that before on Instagram. But I wanted to go back to what you were saying about fitness quickly, because when you said about how where your worth lies and you realize it's not online, it just made me think about how it's a really sad kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, this one, because what happened with me was all my life I'd had quite disordered eating and always wanted to be, I'd never been a really skinny girl. So all I wanted to be was super lean and skinny. I thought it would make me really happy. And so you kind of, you do. I really had my eyes on the prize and I was like, I'm going to get so shredded and everyone's going to love me then. And then you get really lean, in the way I did that was online. And so then my values did become inverse. Like it's like that thing of like whatever you water grows. So I grew a community of people online. I was so obsessed with being lean. And then I realized, like, slam dunk, wow, you know, having abs and being like 16% body fat has not made me happier. It's not made my friendships any better. My grades aren't any better. Like, nothing has improved. I've just got loads of people following me online. And it's sad because that path kind of is set out for us. It's like predestined. It's so many young women and girls are sidetracked by this because that's what we're taught, we're indoctrinated to believe. So irrespective of where you come from or what your background is, it's like we're so set up for a fall. And it's almost as though, and again, you kind of outlined this in your, I can't think it was on your Instagram story, but it's almost like we have to go through as a rite of passage all of this rigmarole and like trauma and stress. And only some of us make it out to the other side where we're able to, as you say, leisurely, kind of slowly do this critical thinking and questioning, like, am I cisgendered? Am I straight? Am I happy being in the body that I'm in? Do I need to ascribe to certain beliefs? Am I interested in whatever it is? Not everyone makes it out because it's such a strong pull. It's such a magnetic force, basically, the capitalist mindset dream that keeps us all, because capitalism and dieting, I guess, are like totally entrenched. Sorry, I've gone so off topic, but it was just making me think how obvious it all is. It's all so deliberate. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I mean, this is not off topic at all. It's all part of the same topic. That's the entire point, you know, with getting back to the political philosophy mixed in with, you know, this we live in this structure and it's like we have agency within it, but only enough that allows us to keep participating within it. It's like we have this, I do think we have like a bit of like obviously free will. And I do think there's, but as you say, it's like we are on this path which is set out, and it is that magnetism. It's that, you know, pull again and again. It's like that sketch in Arrested Development where, I don't know if you've seen it, Tobias and Lindsay are talking in that and they're like, we should try an open marriage. And Lindsay's like, does it work? And Tobias goes, no, it never does. But, and people always fool themselves into thinking that, but it might just work for us. And it's that idea of like, we always think it might slightly be different. And maybe if we just try it, it will be different for us, but it's not. It's just, again, these myths of like capitalism that want us to become these consumers, these commodifying. And now we know how to monetize these journeys. So, you know, you're going on, we go on this fitness journey and even without thinking about it, it becomes part of our own mythology. I read a really interesting essay this week on like main character syndrome and how we all want to be like the main character in our own lives, and how social media has really exacerbated that. But it's, and I think what you're saying about who makes out to the other side is really interesting, because take us, both of us, we're kind of coming out there. We have this space to make it out. And I think you could probably argue the reason we have that space is partly because of the privileges we enjoy, you know. I'm definitely from middle-class background. I think you're from middle-class background too. We both have like these very loving support networks. We both fit in convention. We still are very conventionally like sized. We are like conventional beauty norms. Like that is just who we are as people. And we have been afforded the grace to have that space. We've been, you know, people come to us and they want to hear about almost these issues we've had and the way we've worked through them. Whereas on people who don't fit within these parameters, there's much less grace for them. And they're not really afforded that recovery space. And also, if they do go through that recovery, no one wants to hear about it because it's almost seen as failure for them because they fail to still fit within these conventional norms. Whereas we've gone through these things and it's like we're still within the structures. Now we become voices of rebelling against those norms even when we still fit into them. And it's very funny. It's not in like a ha-ha way. It's in like an way. But we don't want that. Like, that's not something we have ascribed to. It's just the way we fit within these systems, and it's very hard to rebel against that because capitalism is so overpowering. It's like we were talking about at the start, and I don't want to be like, oh, it's just capitalism, because I do think it's a deeper thing. But it's that idea of like, whatever what we do, we can fight as much as we want, but we'll still be ascribed certain roles and norms and probably fit into manners of speaking. It's like my boyfriend the other day was telling me about, you know, the way I talk on Instagram. Like, I speak in influencer speak, if I'm frank with you, like, because of the platform and the way it shapes the voices that you use on it, I do speak in that very like influencer-y conversational tone. I slip into that lexicon very easily. And I wouldn't say I'm an influencer because per se, but I definitely know how, what comes across on that platform best and how to converse on that platform and what will push up my content, as I put it, that I'm sharing on that platform. So it's like, even when I want to talk about the system, I'm still engaging in the system to get my words out there. And so it's really difficult. But I think the answer is really sitting down and doing that thinking and being like, you know what? Sometimes my intention will, you know, do I divest from Instagram altogether? Do I divest from Twitter altogether? But do I accept that sometimes my intention will be misconstrued, whatever happens? And like, I'm operating with a system where it's like, I throw as much of the wall as I can. And, you know, some of it will punch through the wall and some of it will just stick to the wall and become a print that sells on IM5, which I love to buy my bed sheets from. it's that kind of idea.
What you just said then was really powerful, really clever, actually, about how we're given the grace and the room to fail and then still fit within the beauty standards, still fit within the structures, which is why often it's interesting to talk about this. I try not to talk about my relationship with fitness or even my body anymore because I'm so straight. So I'm slim and I'm white and I'm conventionally attractive, as you outlined. I mean, I hate saying that because it sounds like I'm being like, I'm fucking hot. I don't mean that. You know what I mean? Structurally.
Yeah.
The reason I don't like talking about it, but this is why it's so interesting talking about it from an addiction frame point, because I think that is kind of like anyone, no matter who you are, you can have an addiction, but I wasn't marginalized. I'm never marginalized with my body. So talking about that grace to fail is such a good way of explaining this space and why it kind of made me feel a bit icky about having me talking about this. I'm like, oh my God, that's such a perfect way of saying it. It's like, not only am I allowed to go through this, I'm allowed to fail and then carry on. I don't know. I just think you put that so well, and it kind of made me recognize my privilege once again, mid-convo.
it's just a constant record. But it's something that I'm having to grapple with as well, because I've never thought of myself as like being outside the norms in any shape or form, because I'm very aware of, you know, who I am, why I, you know, we talked about earlier how a lot of people are reading the things I'm doing right now. And it's also because I fit within certain molds and people like seeing, you know, young, and I will say attractive, like young, attractive, conventionally attractive. As you say, straight sized. I'm, you know, I pretty much identify as cis at the moment. I want to think outside of that, but I can't like go away from that. Like a basically straight woman who is also a person of color. Like I fit every, like I fit and just enough outside like the palatable frame, but then I'm totally palatable. I'm totally allowed in. Like I'm sort of like the Venn. I'm the Venn diagram of like, you know, a broadcaster's wet dream. It's why they always get mixed race people on to talk about issues that affect non-mixed race people. It's like why are you getting us on to try and talk about like what's affecting dark-skinned black women, because we are almost the bridge that's just spicy enough but not too spicy. So it's something I'm always trying to grapple with, but it's something that's come up a lot recently because I've been talking a lot about the influencer culture. And as I said, so, you know, my boyfriend's like, well, you know, you've done like a lot of like influencer-esque stuff. And I was always like, I actually cried talking to him. I was like, I'm not an influencer. I'm not doing that. And he's like, look at your feed. Like, look at the stuff you post. Look at, like, have, you do need some self-reflection. It's like, in the past, I have definitely engaged, when I was working at a lifestyle magazine, I used to post stuff like, it wouldn't be ads, but it would be like, people would send me free shit. And I'd sometimes be like, this is a really good product. I love it. And like just automatically slipping into that vein and doing those things. So it's not that we have to do the whole communist stand up and do the confess my sins self-flagellation, but it is a constant process of recognizing how we engage within the systems and how, you know, it puts it, the whole thing is to put us in the box of consuming, creating a constant flow of that. And whether we like it or not, you know, the certain voices, we do get promoted to a platform because of who we are. And because, you know, it's hard to break that cycle. It's really hard to break that cycle. It doesn't mean we have to shut up and stop creating and stop, you know, talking and stop allowing our views to air. But it just does mean that we have to try maybe even that little bit harder to make sure that the other people are getting up there with us and extending that hand and being aware of when we don't need to take up that space. And also sometimes just like, I'm trying to log off more, not because I'm like, people don't need to hear what I have to say, even though they don't. It's because for my own peace of mind, it's learning I don't have to share everything. It's learning, it's weird saying this on a podcast where I've confessed a lot of stuff that I've only just started even thinking about or confronting, but privacy. Privacy and like those boundaries of privacy and what the internet needs to know and what it doesn't need to know and what people need to know. And you know, I do pick and choose very carefully what I'm saying to people, and I'm saying this to you because I think this is a really good space for it. But it's interesting. It's like I've got to wean myself off the internet and that internet addiction. I have got like an alt, a secret account that's not so secret now, Twitter account, where I just have like my closest friends, and it's almost like a group chat. And that's why I've now started putting all my like farted out thoughts and silly things, because it makes you question the process of even doing that. And then when you're questioning, you know, should this go on main Twitter? And then you question, does this even need to go on Twitter at all? Maybe not. Maybe I could just sit back and not put this on this platform. And my output on Instagram has really gone down. I still post the odd selfie because I love it. But it's really, my relationship has changed. It's basically just work and a couple of odd pictures. And then it's like I just don't enjoy that platform in the same way anymore because it's not as fulfilling. And I think the pandemic as well is really, as you say, it's that overconsumption that's been through the pandemic, but it's like, God, being outside is just so nice.
Oh my God. It's so interesting, especially talking about like privacy and versus, first of all, thank you for sharing with me. I love talking to you, but I think that there's such a big difference between people say to me, God, you share so much online. I'm like, I actually don't. I'm really open. I don't want to say vulnerable because I don't feel vulnerable in what I'm sharing because I'm very, and also calculated is not the word, it's deliberate what I'm talking about. I'm happy to talk about, I'll talk about certain things too, I talk about my periods, or like it's personal, but it's what I want to share. And it's interesting because I've got really good now at not sharing what people ask me to. So I have the privacy in the sense that people ask me things, I'm just like, I don't owe you the answer to this question. But then I might talk about something which they deem to be way more personal. So it's interesting that kind of like private public, it makes me think going back to uni again, talking about like a room of one's own and like the Victorian times, the blending of the personal and the public. But it is really interesting. It always comes back to those same kind of conversations about like what's happening behind closed doors and what's happening in the public sphere. And in a weird way, the really personal stuff to me, like the stuff that used to be very private, mental health, sex, periods, all those things, they're what I talk about. And the things that I keep private are like what I do on the weekend, how I spend my downtime, you know, what I do with my boyfriend, or like the conversations I have with my friends. That's my really private, because that's my personal public. And then you have like your internet public, which is like a different thing. I don't know. It's a really interesting dichotomy to think about, because it has really changed, and the scope of what we deem to be acceptable common parlance, common conversation has also changed tenfold in the last like 5 to 10 years. So I think that private public concept is really, really interesting, like when we look at social media and what we deem to be personal and what we deem to be private, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's what's really interesting about what you said there is how what things like sex and periods is now, you know, that's internet public. That's something that you may not necessarily talk about it as openly at, like if you're invited to a random dinner with, you know, in a professional setting. But I'd be more likely to talk about that than some other things, because I think this has a lot to do with actually the commodification of feminism and the lexicon that we talk in about it, and how that is, you know, talking about sex is like, it's easy now. It's fine. It's like, yeah, I come. That's radical. So it's like those things. It's like, you know, you have all these like eco-friendly, sustainable women's period places, and it's all about that kind of thing. And it's like, it's actually, yeah, talking about this online is a really cool, radical thing to do. And that's feminism. And that's now means that it's the trickle-down effect. It's like this, I always talk about like the cerulean blue jumper and the Devil Wears Prada, you know, something starts from like this radical place in perhaps, you know, the 20th century. So you have that radical feminist politic. And then as neoliberalism starts, capitalism starts, this commodification of everything around us. So that's geared up really in a huge way in the social media, where everything became content and everything became something to be consumed. Then you have like this, the feminism at the same time as like this big movement, but then it became gobbled up. And it's like talking about, as a woman online, talking like like men talking about sex online, I think would get a very different reception. And it's not that it'd be shamed, it'd just be seen a lot more dirty, I think, unless they were a queer man, because queer men now talking about sex is radical, which, you know, that's different politics. But it's like, it's interesting, as women talking about sex online, that's still like very seen as like, wow, that's really like totally normal and liberation. It's like you can write a whole book about it and sell it to the masses talking about sex and periods. So it is interesting. And I think when we talk about the internet public, what I think about is the stuff that's safe to be consumed. And when you talk about like your personal stuff, like, you know, going on the walks and spending time with your loved ones, that for me is something that I have to keep close to me, because otherwise I feel like I'm cheapening it, because I know when I put stuff out there in a way, it's almost fodder for that commodification and that consumption. And I know that whether I intend that or not, that will happen.
I really live by the idea that when you put things online, no matter how unfiltered, how vulnerable you think you're being, there is always some element of putting it online. Like if you wanted a picture to be private from memory, you would print it out, put it in a drawer. Every time you put something online, it's with the knowledge it's going to be seen. So some, even if it's a tiny percentage, some percentage of authenticity dissipates when you go online.
No, absolutely, like 100%. I'm reading a really interesting, well, I read a really interesting book on Instagram itself, and it's Evolution, which I recommend. It's called No Filter, and it's by Sarah Freer. And it's all about how Instagram grew to what it was. And, you know, from the very beginning, it was based on these spheres of influence, and they signed celebrities up very early. There's a really cute story about Ariana Grande in it, actually, which I recommend everyone to read, to look out for. But it's Instagram, once people realize its marketing purposes, it's almost like it couldn't be anything else. And this is the problem. It's like, much as we want to divest from the, you know, forge our own path, and we might be posting, as you say, completely with our own intentions, you know, want to be unfiltered and raw, but because, you know, we're so versed in this platform and the structure, and it forces us into something else, whether we like it or not. And it's like, you know, when you get people messaging you about wanting to consume parts of yourself on that platform, it doesn't matter. It will always make you feel a bit cheapened by it, because it doesn't matter what your intention is, because of what the platform is, that is how it's going to be received now. It's very hard to get away from that. And also, once you're disillusioned with it, it's also hard to reinvest that emotional connection in it that you might have once had. So the communities that you built and that joy you got from it, it's difficult now. These platforms feel fatiguing. Like I love it when people, you know, I don't love it actually. I like it when people message me, and I appreciate it, but it also feels really tiring, because I can't give them what I want to give them just over an Instagram DM or a Twitter DM. I have, like, if I'm gonna work with you or do something with you, I can do that in a different sphere. But the conversation, you know, people will message me off the back of a tweet and start like a conversation that they want to have, like this in-depth conversation. And I totally appreciate that, but I just don't have the energy to do it anymore, because it's not somewhere that I think can actually start. I think it's a conversation, like, as we say, we tweet, and it exists in its own little vacuum. And if I'm going to have a conversation, I want to be having it elsewhere. And it's not the fault of the people who message me. I should know better than to just be tweeting, not expecting any responses. But I just can't give them what they want. And I feel so like disappointed and guilty myself, not having the ability to like want to message back about, you know, the media structures. Because even if I've tweeted about them, because I'm just like, I don't have it in me right now to do that.
Do you know one thing that, and I don't know if you use it, but I remember, and maybe it's a helpful tool for some people, but one thing that really made me feel a bit sick and like disenfranchised from platforms was when that app called Blinkist came about, that basically gave you like a synopsis and summary and like chapter breakdown of like any book that you could ever read. And I was like, this is obscene, because I, first of all, love reading books. I don't understand people that say, oh, I pick and read bits. I'm like, what happens if halfway through they're like, oh my God, I loved Hitler and you didn't know? And then you're like, I love this book. I don't know. I have to read things cover to cover. Even if I hate it, I want to know what happens. But I just found it interesting that we were doing everything sort of, it became for content. So before, what it was is we had an idea, we had a concept and we wanted to share it, and the content was the result. Whereas now the content is the goal. So you kind of work backwards from the content, if that makes sense. And so everything is kind of like, we know what we have to achieve. And it's like when you first go to uni and you write an essay and you come up with all these ideas, and then you Google things to back up the idea that you've already said. So you haven't actually researched anything. You've just found a line in an essay and been like, and as we see here, And there's actually no real depth to it. Like, that's what Instagram and social media and everything has kind of become. I feel like before it was really full of like real, genuine new thoughts and ideas and communication and like, wow. And now it's sort of like, right, I know what I want to be saying. How can I back this up in the like the quickest, snappiest way possible? It's not to say there's anything wrong with that. And maybe that's really ableist of me to talk about like reading whole books, and those things are probably really helpful for research and whatever. I mean, when they're used cynically and when they become part of this machine of sort of smoke and mirrors, I guess, that's when I start to feel like with the platform, as you say, that real sense of fatigue. And like, I actually have started posting way more meaningless shit because I'm like, there's no point in me. I love doing it on the podcast. I have the room to talk. It's like the best thing ever. But on Instagram, there's probably no point in me writing a really lengthy caption that I've spent hours writing, because fundamentally it's just going to get swallowed up and eat and spit out, and like, no one's going to see it. And do you know, it is exhausting as a platform, I would say, for deep stuff.
It's funny you mentioned Blinkist, because that is something that lives in my mind rent-free. And I always think about it as the sort of archetypal late-stage capitalism, rise and grind, hustle, 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 get this book read in 15 minutes. And I can't comment whether it's ableist or not, but I think there's, you know, there's audio books, there's other, like so many other forms of things. And Blinkist was not designed to be something that was, and it might be useful to that community, the disabled community, but it wasn't designed as that. It was designed to make, it was designed and promoted as hustle culture. It was designed and promoted as something that to make the consumption of knowledge quicker without actually doing the in-depth and the context and the full sort of like understanding of the topic. Blinkist is something that I really do think is indicative of this approach. As you say, logging on with these entrenched positions to back it up, and rather than coming in with an open mind, or at least a curious mind. I think a curious mind is one of the best things we can have right now, but it takes time to unlearn not being curious. I don't think I've been curious. Like I remember being very curious when I was maybe 18, 19. And then, you know, something happened. I got very online. I got entrenched. I got very entrenched. And it's only recently in the last like year or so that I've started being curious again and started wanting to have my mind changed in a way. And I'm not talking about the things like, as we said, like I'm not talking about abhorrent views or things that I fundamentally know against my principles, but I'm talking about just changing the way I think about things and changing the way I think about the way the world works 100% and understanding more about the systems behind that, rather than just going like, oh yeah, it's because of capitalism and tailing off because I don't know exactly how that system is going. And it's interesting. I wonder how did you used to feel when you wrote your like big long captions versus how have you felt recently? Do you like writing the captions itself, or does that feel like a chore?
So I love writing my book reviews. I find it really fun, and I think it's like a good. It's quite hard to do a book review in like a small space of time. So that I find that fun as a genuine exercise of my own. Like, how can I fit this into this and make it make sense and make people excited to read, because I love reading and I find that I'm like, that's part of my Instagram that I feel really proud of. I'm like, I want people to read, I want it to be cool, I like the fact that I'm sharing something that isn't about me. My Instagram is my work platform and I share what I'm wearing, and it is quite capitalist in that it's how I make a lot of my income, and it gives me the room to read, research, think about what I want to write, think about doing my comedy. It kind of, now it gives me the space to do the arts that I really want to be doing. So I don't really write as many long captions. And when I do, I get really excited because I'm like, yay, I'm doing something helpful. But I also feel like it feels pointless because I feel like it's not enough. As you say, like I tried to do a series, which actually was quite, it worked quite well, where I do Let's Talk About, and I did a really long Instagram TV video. And then I would get all of my audience to kind of reply, and I would stay online, literally on my page for 3 hours, replying to really, really long comments. That was fruitful because it wasn't just me putting something out into ether and then going bye. But again, Instagram's not quite the right platform to facilitate it. Like, it's me being online in focus, like in comments for 3 hours, isn't actually like the best use of my time, which is why I love my book clubs, because we would have like these kind of conversations we're having now with a group of 20 women for 3 hours in real life. And that's what I love. So I do like writing a caption, but then I kind of feel like the next day, a bit like I was saying with the Britney Spears documentary, like you could say something you think is interesting, but really you need to be talking about something for weeks or months. Like, it needs to be like investigative journalism for it to really come out with any kind of fruitful ending. So I guess sometimes I do write them, but I feel deflated, I guess.
I think what you've come up against is the limitations of something like Instagram. And the thing about these platforms is, and it's really great that you, and I was going to mention your book club, because I was like, this is quite clearly, that's also why like you had those spaces outside externally, because you are someone who enjoys having that conversation, that in-depth space, and building that with people around you. You're obviously someone who likes connection and having those connections with other people and hearing from them. But Instagram is a very one-sided thing. It's like you have a lot of followers who often are, you know, in a position of quite idolizing you as well. And I speak as, you know, a former follower who didn't know you. It's like I respected what you were saying online. I was like, oh, this girl seems really nice and interesting. But you have a parasocial relationship with you. So it's I was going to talk about that, but it's also, it's like you think that these platforms will make it better, but you've got like Clubhouse, but I find that that's almost worse than what we're experiencing now, because I thought that Clubhouse would be like a really great platform full of potential, but it's just like Twitter on crack. It's like Twitter just times 10, where everyone's just yelling at each other and the same conversations are happening again and again and again. And the thing about all of these platforms is they are ephemeral. They're not going to be here in X amount of years. And that's also what I meant when I said it's great you're building outside, because, you know, you've got your comedy, you've got these spaces, you've got like a goal that won't solely rest on Instagram. And Instagram, we don't know how the longevity it has. We don't know how Twitter's longevity is. Like, remember Facebook? Do you remember how much time you spent on Facebook as a teenager? How much time do you spend on Facebook now?
Oh my God, I never go on it. It freaks me out.
Yeah, it's Facebook now is it's a horrible design, but it's also, it has nothing for us. We don't have our conversations on there. Our social lives aren't there. I only maintain my Facebook profile in case I need to like talk to sources for a story, or if, you know, someone from my past, I need to reach out to you for some unknown reason. But Facebook is no longer a part of my social life. And the disillusionment I find with Facebook is something that we will soon enough, I think, apply to Instagram and Twitter, whether we realize it or not, the same way we applied it to Bebo, the same way it was for MySpace, which was before my time, the same way all these networks have lived and died, because we love to consume, we love to have the new thing, but it's also, these places don't make us happy in the long run.
Not at all. Now, I love this. I'm just... realize how we were talking. I don't want to go on too long, but I wanted to ask you about your third thing, because I think this is such an important one, and also we could talk about this for about an hour. But your third thing, and I love that you said this, is achievement myths, and you put like meritocracy, validation for being academic, etc. I think this is so important, because I mean, I've just turned 27, fellow Pisces over here, and I'm having this like sense of crisis, because I'm like, I'm never going to be on this Forbes 30 under 30 list. And like, I haven't written a book and I haven't done all of these things. And it's like, when did your 20s become this time for you to achieve things that people would dream about? Like when I was younger, I always used to want to be an author, but I would imagine myself as a 50-year-old being an author who'd have written like some sci-fi fantasy book. And all of a sudden, these achievement, I mean, maybe I'm taking this slightly differently from you, but these myths of achievement to me are now like sort of that you're going to be, we're luckily in happy relationships, but all these really ridiculous milestones that actually the older you get, you start to realize, shit, there is no kind of linear order in which this happens. And it may never happen either, and you kind of having your bubble burst at every step of the way. And it can be really deflating. Tell me if I've interpreted that wrong. Is that what you meant?
No, you've interpreted it very right. There's so many levels to this. So the first of all, what we can talk a bit about that achievement myth, this age thing, the age aspect, which I think is so key. And I do think this is, again, funnily enough, linked to social media and the performance online and how we, you know, idealize the younger you are now, the younger and shinier you are, then the more you get things, opportunities thrown at you. So of course, that's just like a self-perpetuating cycle where the people we see risen to prominence. The people we see who've risen to prominence are going to be younger and younger and younger. And it's that sort of self-cannibalizing thing where the media will latch on to like the next young thing and the next young thing, and the cycle's even quicker. And before you know it, it's every 2 weeks rather than every like 2 months or 2 years. So yeah, the age thing is a massive one, because it's funny. When I was younger, my sister and I used to play a game, and that game would be this game where we imagined, one of us would suddenly go like, oh, wow, we're having a great time in London. And we'd, the other one would have to play along. It was a game of make-believe where you'd have to snap into being these two characters where we were pretending we were older. And my and we'd like be grown up. And I'd always be in London and I'd be writing. And I would never be past the age of 25. And I would always have everything figured out by the age of 25. Funnily enough, we were never married in these scenarios because I come from a single parent family where the idea of marriage was like, what? Why? So we were very much like, I'm at university and I've written a book. And I've got a boyfriend and we're going to a party tonight. So so when I'm now, I've actually reached 25, it's almost like, I don't know. My mum did things later in life, which is, she, I mean, she did all her like, university when she was like in her 20s, but she didn't have me and my sister until she was about in her 40s. She got her doctorate in her 40s. So I also did have that model there of like, you don't have to do everything when you're young. And I'm just, I'm very aware of how much life there is to live. And I do see, I am very worried by, particularly for young women, because it's always young women who have these myths thrown at us about youth in the first place and like this ageism. And online, I get so many like young journalists telling me how, you know, worried they are, they're never going to make it. And they're like 19, 19. And I don't want to be, you know, have anything figured out until I'm at least like, even what I want to do till I'm 35. I don't want to even be in journalism, I don't think, beyond maybe 35. I want to do several things. I want to like live out there. So that's one of the achievements I was talking about. The other one's in like the terms of meritocracy. That for me is things like thinking, you know, when you're taught you're young, if you work hard and you can achieve anything you want, it's just absolute bollocks. And you know, people like me who come from that solid middle class background and have, you know, had a lot of luck. I didn't have hookups. I didn't have any like family nepotism or anything like that, apart from when I worked at Urban Outfitters because my cousin was the manager of that. But I didn't, in the media, I didn't have any hookups, only for the 40% Urban Outfitters discount. But it's like I haven't had nepotism, but I've been very lucky and I've had, you know, when I was like properly broke, my family didn't have what I would call like money, but just enough to like make sure that they could send me like 100 quid if I was really broke. And that is, you know, I always knew I was going to go to university. I always knew I was going to do this thing. So I've had that sort of like, I've had a comfortable path. I've always had a safety net. And other people who don't have those safety nets, it's not a meritocracy. There's a reason that, for example, Black women are likely to be the lowest paid across all industries. We know that inequality is both, it intersects in the way it's racial, it's geographic, these things all come together. You know, there's a reason that ethnic minorities in this country, I think it's if you're Black in general, you'll pay up to 10 times less than a white person doing the same role. We don't live in a meritocracy, and the fact that we peddle that myth is dangerous for two reasons. One, you know, it obscures the real root cause of inequality, which is discrimination and lack of investment, and it creates a myth where people who are successful don't want to talk about the reasons they might be successful that might not be just due to their hard work. It's like, I've worked very hard, but I also have other things in place. And from very young, you don't want to undermine your own abilities by doing that if you're taught this meritocracy myth. And it starts in all the way in school. It starts with, you know, when you're sorted into sets and somebody who might be, you know, we had kids in the bottom set who were very smart and bright, but weren't academically bright. They couldn't, you know, they might have either, sometimes they had learning difficulties, sometimes it was just the academic structures of school did not suit their way they learned. It didn't feed them. It wasn't nourishing for them. And it didn't, and they were looked upon as like the least able. And that affects every other opportunity you're offered from then on. Once you're sorted into these mindsets of like, if you're not academically bright or you're not suited to the academic, system in the UK, which is very much sort of like regurgitating facts, it's having a lot of like surface level knowledge, you know, that's sticks in your record. And because we've taken away a lot of like apprenticeships and traineeships, the vocational careers are not seen as good. And because we've marketed like education, higher education is now seen as both a necessity and it's seen as a, you know, marketization of a higher education, whereas, you know, university is seen as a business rather than you learn for learning's sake. You have to pay a lot of money to go there. You get into a lot of debt. It's immediately setting up these people to fail and not live lives where they can either learn in adulthood or they can just go and do things that aren't to do with like memorizing, you know, French verbs. It's so unfair. But I was infected with that sort of like academic, because I was always very academic. My mum was, before she was a yoga teacher, which and this was before yoga teaching was very cool. So she was just teaching yoga to old ladies in our rural village. But she was a lecturer. So she was a lecturer. So and my dad, before he ran off, was also a PhD student and a lecturer. So like I technically come from a background of academics, which I only recently realized, oh, that's why, you know, I've been pushed to be academic. And of course I had a snobbery about academics when I was young because I was told that was what was key. And it's like, it's not. And having that snobbery is something you have to unlearn. And it's really difficult because it pushes in you an arrogance and a disdain that is just so ugly. So those are things I'd have loved to learn much younger about this myth of meritocracy and the achievements we talked about at the age and like, you know, the pressure to achieve. You know, the idea of having a lifelong career is no longer, and this is partly because of like the form of capitalism. We're late stage capitalism where jobs don't last as long. We have all these forms of like new gig economies. Precarious employment is far more prevalent. So it's the idea of, and also the idea of having to have more than one job in order to even afford the cost of living, which makes no sense because the economy is a made up thing by the government and they can control those rates if they wanted to, but they just don't. But yeah, it speaks to that. But it's also like, we do have more choice and that's so freeing. Why on earth would I want to do the same thing for my entire life if I didn't have to? And like, I always think of, I know Tracee Ellis Ross is a very rich, lucky person who is the daughter of Diana Ross, but she's sort of like my idol in that sense, and that she just goes and does whatever the fuck she wants. And she does do that because she's got money, but it's that idea of on the scale of she, I don't know how old Tracee Ellis Ross is and I've never bothered looking it up because it just doesn't seem relevant. The same thing with Robin, even though she's a singer, but I've never bothered looking at Robin's age because it's just not relevant to the work she does to me at all. Mm. And I don't want to be on a 30 under 30 list because it doesn't feel relevant to the work I'm doing. It's like, I think only like now it goes back to that point you were saying about like, when did your 20s become when you had to know everything and it was, you know, and you had to have everything figured out. And it's like, why on earth does someone trust me, a 25-year-old, to tell them what's what about the world? Why? I've only just begun living. I've literally just begun going out into the world and realizing how little I know. Why are you listening to me to like give you the lowdown? I can give you my opinion and I can give some analysis as I see it now, but that might be completely different in 10 years' time. And I think it's having that room to like grow and change is such a luxury. And the fact that we like, if we have that, we should use it. God, I can't wait to like do so many things. It's like, I have dreams about stuff, projects I'll start and things I'll do. I don't have a 5-year plan. I just have like vague goals of like, okay, in the future, I would love to start up some sort of, I guess what you call like a bursary system, a program that allows children from deprived areas to go out and travel like the world and sort of like replacement for in-training but fully funded and all of that. And I have no idea how I could do that, but that's one of the things I want to do in my life. It's like, there's so many, there's got nothing to do with journalism whatsoever at all. So it's funny because I do think that this also has a lot to do with like, but at the same time, it's like, how do we achieve those things without falling into like the hustle culture? Because I don't want to do that as like a performance thing. I don't want to do that as part of hustle. I want to do that on my own terms. I don't want to be doing that because it's like, this is girl boss rise and grind. I just want to be doing that because it's an organic thing that will make me happy. And does that mean, again, divesting from the performance of doing that online? But yeah, this whole like churning, like I've been, because of the recent opportunities I've been approached for, it's like someone, I got asked, you know, do I want to, by a literary agent. A literary agent approached me and I was just like, I don't need to write a book. I don't have anything in me to write about in that sense. I've got nothing to say yet. And that's fine. That's really okay. And I think it's just more exciting to realize that there's just so much out there that you have yet to do. And it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be tied to this one thing. You don't have to be trapped in this thing forever because you are so young and you're just starting to figure it out.
I had the exact same experience where I had a literary agent come to me and I was like, no, I'm not ready. And they kept pestering me and I was like, shit, I've got to do it. And then someone else came to me and I was like half writing it. And then I basically had like a breakdown. I was like, I don't want to be writing a book. I'm not ready. I don't feel, and thank fuck I didn't as well, because the book I was going to be writing was like not my place. Now that I'm really glad that I didn't do it, but they knew it was sellable off the back of the podcast. They knew that like I would get the audience, people would buy it. But it's like, I keep making really stupid, trite jokes about turning 27 and how I feel old. But really how I feel is I woke up on my 27th birthday and I cried because I was so happy, because I've never felt so weirdly in the middle of this, everything that's going on. I've had some really difficult things happen during this pandemic, but I'm so in love with my boyfriend. I've been going to therapy. My friendships are all really strong. I've had a stable income throughout this pandemic. And I suddenly start, I think I know who I am a bit more. And I woke up and I cried because I was so happy because I was like, this is who you are. And I was like, that's only starting to happen now. Mm. Like, I'm 27 and I still don't fully know, but I feel like I think I know about 100% for certain. 20% of me I'm like 100% sure about. And the rest of it I'll figure out by the time I'm 70.
Do you know what, that made me well up a little bit, because that's also very similar to how I feel. But it's also, it's that idea that when you catch on to, I know how it feels when you catch on to how knowing yourself a little bit more, and like for the first time in years, you think, I have a bit of a root. This is the root to who I am now. Like I think a lot of the difficulty, and you know, this pandemic again, I've had a lot of difficult things happen, and therapy's been hard, but I've been so lucky to come out of it with a much better understanding of who I am, what I want, like not in the terms of like, I want this career, I want the next career, but just like the vague sort of like, I want this to be happy. I want to do this. I want to be with this person. I want to do X, Y, Z. It's like having that just it makes life bright again. I think for so long I was very unhappy. Mm-hmm. I was very unhappy, and I was walking around with those pressures and those like ideas of like achievement, but also just like not knowing who I was. And the idea of who I was the person I was at 21. And I'd been holding on to that idea of that's who I was, and that's how I went about things, and that's how I operated through life. And that's, you know, that's Moya, the 21-year-old who likes, like, you know, this kind of partying, and this what makes her happy, and that what makes her happy. And I'm reaching 26 and I realize that is not me. And the separation and the distance between those two people had been making me so unhappy, because I was looking for that happiness in all the wrong places, because I'd completely developed and changed without realizing it. And it was again that absolutism. That's, you know, I'm this type of personality. I'm a Pisces and I'm an INFP. And it's like every time I take that fucking Myers-Briggs test, it actually tells you something different. And I just ignore it completely because it's actually made up pseudoscience. there's a book about it. It was created by these two eugenicist women in America who had no actual scientific training, but it's used by so many people. But yeah, so it's that idea, and it's that rubbing up of those two personalities and coming to terms with that you've changed. And when you find, you know, like that waking up and crying on your birthday just because you feel more at home in yourself than you have in years is something that's so wonderful and relatable. So yeah, that made me a bit emotional.
We've been really disparaging about the internet and social media on this podcast. However, it is where we both reside. And so if people did want to find you or get to know you a bit more or follow your work, where should we be looking for you?
I feel really bad doing. I don't know if I even could actually do this, because the last time I did this, my boyfriend said, the fact that you promoted your socials at the end just undermined everything you said. So you know what? I'm just going to say Google my name if you want to find me. I'm just going to say either Google my name or go on Galdem and read some of the stuff on there, but I'm not going to promote my socials for once.
Really? But why does it undermine?
I will promote this podcast on my socials.
I think I love the sound of your boyfriend, but I think he's mean. I think you're allowed to put your socials on here. Also, your Twitter is very much like a workspace. Like for journalists especially, Twitter is like a hub of information, I think.
I think it is. But I also know that, I guess, if I'm really serious about trying to build up, you know, this a following just for the sake of the following that's not just on my platforms. Because as we talked about, I do think that Twitter and Instagram and all of that is ephemeral. And, you know, where will I be in 10 years if, you know, apart from when I quit journalism, but where will I be if the people are only coming to my socials? And then once I disappear from my socials, am I just dead to the world? Will people still look for the work I'm doing outside of that? So I guess the best place to start to try and encourage, maybe a following that's seeks things outside of those platforms it's a good day to do it. So I'm just going to say Google my name if you're interested in reading more of my work, and I'm sure you'll find my socials through that, but there's stuff out there, and you never know, you could dig up all the old articles my mum doesn't want anyone to see, like the ones they wrote about when I took pictures of kebab men when I was drunk and got in a load of papers. So you can find that instead of my like political analysis.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I think this is going to be the longest episode this season, but by far one of my favorites. I've absolutely adored chatting to you, and I'm so pleased that you agreed to come on.
Thank you so, so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. It's been an extra therapy session. And yeah, I got even more out of it than I expected. And I expected a lot. So it's been a real joy.
Oh, that's good. Well, thank you everyone for listening as well. And I will see you next week. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.